There's been a lot of talk about, like, oh, we're becoming an increasingly secular world, disenchanted, you know, all of those sorts of narratives. And I'm just not convinced that that's the full story, at the very least. I think that we're not done with a sense of God's mysterious presence in our lives. And even people who seem to be secular authors still sometimes are very fascinated by this kind of pursuit of divine intimacy.
I learned about Andrew Prevost when I read his award-winning book, Thinking Prayer, Theology and Spirituality Amid the Crises of Modernity, published in 2015. I was so struck by the way this book puts spiritual and intellectual life into conversation with each other that I invited Andrew to be a guest at the BYU Humanities Center. I now consider him a friend. He's an associate professor of theology at Boston College, and we're talking today about a new book he's written that'll be coming out next year, titled The Mysticism of Ordinary Life. I'm Matthew Wickman of the BYU Faith and Imagination Institute. Andrew, good to see you.
It's great to be with you, Matt.
I'm seeing you over Zoom. I wish it was in person. We've known each other for about five-ish years, and I've been hoping to talk with you on the podcast ever since it began nearly 2 years ago. And you know, I became acquainted with you because I read your wonderful first book, Thinking Prayer. So I was intrigued to read Maria Clara Bingemers. Is that how you say her name?
Yes, that's right.
Her foreword to your forthcoming book, The Mysticism of Ordinary Life. And in that foreword, she comments on the development of your latest book out of the work that you began in that first book, Thinking Prayer. And I want to ask you this. Do you see this latest book as further progress in your thinking, or did you conceive of this book as departure from that earlier book?
I really see it as a continuation, as building on this research project that may, you know, God willing, take me through another several decades of my life, which is an effort to kind of retrieve and think about the meaning of Christian spirituality in the midst of our world today, with all of the various challenges that we are facing, you know, in this time and place. And so that's what I was trying to do in Thinking Prayer, and it's what I'm continuing to try to do in this book about the mysticism of ordinary life. So, but things have developed, you know, so, well, one obvious shift is shifting from prayer per se to mysticism, which is its own can of worms.
Indeed, yes.
So to speak. And then, you know, some of the kind of theoretical resources I was using changed a little bit. So the first book I'm engaged with some, you know, phenomenologists. There's a little bit of that in this book, but I'm also dealing with some psychoanalytic influenced thinkers here. So that's a kind of different set of conversations. And in terms of social political issues, the first book I really was focusing on problems of poverty and anti-Semitism and anti-Blackness as some social problems that I think prayer has something to offer to. And in this current book, I'm thinking about some of the intersections between those issues and problems around sexism and gender inequality. And so that in a way was a departure for me in the sense that it is something new, but I do see it as continuous.
Okay. You know, I love the way that your work brings such, I think, clear and insightful reflection to how theology broadly conceived. It could be the practice of theology in prayer. It could be the thinking about theology, you know, kind of the philosophically oriented things. How it brings that theology into conversation with really important intellectual thought, philosophy, but also into thinking about these really important social matters that engage us. You're one of my favorite theologians, Andrew. You really are. So,
oh, thanks, Matt.
In fact, recently someone on Twitter asked, name five favorite theologians. And I thought, I'll take up on that. I thought about, well, who are they? I thought, well, in alphabetical order, there was Sarah Bachelard, a former guest on the podcast, Belton Lane, a former guest on the podcast, Thomas Merton, a Catholic theologian who died back in 1968, Andrew Prevost, and Joseph Smith. You know,
so
you know, you're one of five.
I feel incredibly humbled and honored to be included in that list.
Well, no, you're just a really gifted thinker, Andrew.
Thank you so much.
A question for you, right? So I love how your books engage mystical theology with this wider range of philosophical thought, like I said. But for many philosophically minded people, there is some kind of personal impetus for why they study what they do. I'm wondering what the attraction is for you of mystical theology.
Well, as I reflect on that question, I'm aware of the fact that I'm a sensitive person. Some might say a highly sensitive person. And so that has, ever since I was young, made me feel attuned both to the suffering of others, as well as to the deep sorts of mysteries of goodness and joy and beauty that are present in life, and that I attribute really to the presence of God and God's grace in our world. And so for me, I think I've had a kind of mystical sensibility mm-hmm. for a very long time. And this book is trying to, in a way, theorize and name that part of just my own way of perceiving the world. So that's, I think, my personal investment. I don't know, my students sometimes ask me if I consider myself a mystic, and I'm hesitant to kind of give myself that title. But I do think I can claim to have some sort of mystical sensibility about me.
Yeah, yeah, I love that. I love the idea of being sensitive, being a sensitive person, and trying to understand how God then helps us understand that world to which we are sensitive. It's actually beautifully said. So let me ask you about mysticism then. Some faith traditions use the term mysticism very broadly. My own faith tradition, you know, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, does not employ the term mysticism very much, so maybe unfamiliar to some of this podcast listeners. How do you understand the term mysticism, and what do you mean by the mysticism of ordinary life, which is in your book title?
Yes, this is great. I mean, mysticism, despite being in my title, is a term that I could kind of take or leave. It's a very contested and equivocal term. I mean, it means different things to different people. A common joke, at least within my own Catholic tradition, is that mysticism starts in mist and ends in schism, which is, you know, capturing some sort of truth. You know, it really began actually as a pejorative term, you know, as a way to kind of ridicule people who were thought to be going beyond what was orthodox and clear. And but there has been a tradition of people who have used it positively to refer to the experience of union with God, or the experience of a deep intimacy with God that's a gift of God's very self in someone's life and heart and mind. And that's really what I mean by it. So for me, mysticism is about the grace of divine union. Mm. And for much of the Christian tradition, the working assumption of a lot of people was that you had to become a monk or, you know, live a very austere contemplative life in order to access this sort of grace, that it was something very rare and elite. But from the 20th century onward, perhaps before, there's been a real push to say, no, it doesn't, you don't have to go live on Mount Athos or in a monastery in the desert somewhere. You can be in your ordinary everyday life and still cultivate a deep sense of God's presence to you, and that there's something mystical about that as well. So by using that phrase, the mysticism of ordinary life, which I'm taking from a theologian named Karl Rahner, I'm trying to kind of think about that larger, you know, net of mystical experiences beyond just the most sort of religiously elite.
That's great. And one thing I really love about your work, what you say, first of all, really resonates with me, that you need not, you know, sort of be live a monastic life to have a life which seeks union with God, and that can learn to approach God more confidently and with greater understanding, you know, over time. You connect that kind of attentiveness to kind of the upper reaches of thought and kind of broad aspects of experience so well, Andrew, and how you approach the subject. So let me ask you this then, right? So one aim of the book is to bring, as you say, this mystical tradition, this conversation with present-day experience, and there are some great, very insightful discussions of modern theologians. You know, Karl Rahner is one, Hans Urs von Balthasar is another, there are many others. There are philosophers in the book, there are theorists of modern and postmodern life. You get to the topics of like race and class and gender. We'll get to these things here in a moment. Let me ask you though about a couple of the choices you had to make in writing the book and what's not there, right? So here's first question. You bring mystical theology into conversation with important women writers and writers who explore issues of class and black writers, but it's still a philosophical book, which I think is a strength of the book. But when you go into that kind of philosophy, your readership's going to be kind of more philosophically attuned, often more educated. So why not write a book about the mysticism of ordinary life in, say, relative to popular culture or everyday religious practices? Why still pursue it in this philosophical kind of way?
Well, first of all, I'd love to read a book like that. And maybe it would be a good idea for me to pursue that at some point if it doesn't exist or someone else isn't doing such a good job.
Robert Orsi, like Sacred Presence, something like this.
Right, yeah, that kind of thing. Even though some people describe my work as ambitious, which is probably fair, I do view it as kind of limited in its goals and aims. And really, I was trying to make a kind of intervention in a scholarly conversation that's been ongoing for a number of decades about the mysticism of ordinary life across a few different disciplines. And so really, I'm responding to works that have a certain kind of method that I'm mirroring to some degree. So that's shaped my sense of audience and my sense of what to include and exclude. It would be wonderful to think about these questions in the midst of pop culture or through maybe a more sort of ethnographic or sociological kind of lens where you might be doing empirical research on, you know, communities and their religious experience. I think that would all be wonderful.
It would be, although I've got to say, I asked that question not in complaint, because personally, I love there's how you take these topics into kind of the outer bounds of what's been thought, you know, philosophically. I love that intersection you create between theology and philosophy in the book. To me, it's a strength, but it does involve a choice, right? That's why I asked
right.
that.
Right, it is a choice. And if I might say one more thing about this, mysticism has often been construed as something sort of emotional, that's not very rigorous, that, you know, as soon as you start talking about that, you're not doing real intellectual work anymore. And so part of the reason why I gravitate toward that kind of high intellectual discourse is to some degree maybe to legitimize this and say, you know, in the eyes of an academy that may be skeptical of it, to say, no, this is really worth thinking about and taking seriously.
Very good. I like that. And I think that you certainly, I mean, you make some people in the book, like, for example, we may not get to this, but there's a great chapter there where you discuss Michel de Certeau, a French theorist who I read in grad school, you know, writing about things like historiography and how language confronts events in history and creates all kinds of philosophical pools. You bring out kind of the mystical dimensions of de Certeau's thought, which I think is brilliant. And I love it. So bravo you for doing what you do. And it does really kind of bring some dignity to mystical theology to bring it into conjunction with these kinds of writers who are recognized across the academy. So I thought it was the right choice. Let me ask you about one other thing you don't discuss, though, before we get to things that you do discuss. So I belong to this sort of interfaith study group, inter-university study group, hosted by the BYU Humanities Center on the subject of spirituality. And several in the group are eco-theologians or eco-spiritual thinkers. Did you give any thought to addressing the relationship between mystical theology and non-human life, that is, these experiences of God that address our connections with and responsibility for the non-human world?
Well, it's such an important question in our world right now as we're facing so many ecological crises. And it's not, again, a major motif in the work. I do touch on it a little bit when I talk about Catherine Keller, and to some degree also when I talk about Alice Walker. I will say that it's on my mind as something to engage more directly in the subsequent work. You know, I'm actually thinking about doing a sort of third entry in this spirituality and modernity kind of project on asceticism and ways that forms of kind of self-restraint may be necessary to kind of curb our human impact on our natural world and what that might look like. And Pope Francis has talked about this in relation to St. Francis of Assisi's Canticle of Brother Sun, which could be read as both a mystical and an ecological text. One other thought I have is that people have been doing some interesting work on Hildegard of Bingen and her metaphor of grace, divine grace, as a greenness. And the way that for her, plants and flowers and just the kind of verdant world in which we live are all manifestations of divine activity. And ways to kind of connect with God. And so for me, I think there are a lot of opportunities to develop this. It's just not something I've done to the same degree as other things just yet.
Yeah, well, I love what you've done. If you do, though, write that book, you've got a reader in me. I'd love to see that.
Okay, thanks.
So yeah, at least one reader, Andrew, check. You got it. Okay. So, let me ask you now about some of the things you address in the book. So I'll ask you about chapters 4, 5, and 6. The first three chapters, you know, very theological and philosophical. And chapters 4, 5, and 6, you start connecting those things to some social issues, and you get into some matters of sort of intersectional issues. Like chapter 4 is about intersections of race and gender, and you discuss how two really prominent French theorists, Luce Irigaray and Julia Kristeva, view femininity as what you describe as a dark continent in a male-dominated philosophical tradition. And that this kind of sort of dark continent imaginary, you say, quoting you here, remains tethered to a colonial fantasy of Black Africa as maximal other. It's like the most other you can get, right? You know, there's so much imagery in mystical theology of, you know, dark versus light, references to dark nights of the soul, you know, talk about descending into darkness, et cetera. So let me ask this question pretty bluntly. Is this racist language? And if it is, how do we avoid it, especially if we view experiences of God as associated with kind of mind-opening understanding, which invite associations of brightness and their correlative opposites, et cetera. Is this mystical language of ours racist?
Well, I want to say two things about that very important question. One is that I believe it can function that way. And so there's a need to be vigilant and aware of how this imagery is functioning. So how would it function that way if we assume that to be dark is to be something negative? You know, if we assume it has to do with ignorance or evil or suffering or pain, and then if we're consciously or unconsciously transferring those associations onto people's bodies, you know, where we view someone who's of darker complexion and assume unthinkingly perhaps that, oh, this is evil, scary, ignorant, bad. So I do think we need to be on guard against that. However, what I would also say is that people of color, like everyone, you know, we have experiences of not knowing, of suffering, of disorientation in ordinary life as well as in our mystical and spiritual lives, that I think this tradition of mystical darkness kind of helps to name and paradoxically to illuminate. Often, you know, going back to Dionysius, it's a brilliant darkness. So it's this juxtaposition of contradictory ideas where we find the presence of God. And so I don't think it would make sense to attempt to kind of eradicate this way of imagining things, because I think it can do some important work for people who have gone through, you know, the middle passage of the transatlantic slave trade, or who have wrestled with, you know, various opaque aspects of their experience, often as a marginalized person in the world, but have still found God in the midst of that. So I do want to rehabilitate divine darkness, but with a kind of asterisk.
Yeah, great, good. You know, just this week at BYU, someone gave a lecture here. A Catholic theologian who teaches at Holy Cross was out here, and he gave a really good lecture, and he talked about John of the Cross, was it 16th century Spanish mystic, poet, and writer, and talked about this famous dark night of the soul as being this dazzling darkness, this brilliant darkness, as being essential to spiritual growth. It's a great talk, and goes right to the point you're making here. I appreciate that talk, and I appreciate what you write in the book about this. And I've read essays before you've written on this I thought were really, really good. So thank you for that clarification. One of the chapters of the book addresses what you call mestizo or mestiza mysticism. Did I say that correctly?
Yes, yes.
Okay. In doing so, you get to some really important intersectional categories. So gender as it intersects with class, or gender and class as they intersect with race. Were you familiar with this body of work, this mestizo or mestiza mysticism, before you began writing the book? If not, what drove you to sort of take on this category of mysticism?
It actually is something I've been familiar with for a very long time. So I grew up in Colorado. There was a fairly significant Latina population there, as well as, you know, spent some time in New Mexico and so on. And so this notion of a kind of hybrid, culturally hybrid identity between that was born of the trauma of the Spanish conquests of the Americas, but that has found resilience through creative forms of art and music and food, and but also spirituality, has been something kind of in the back of my mind for a very long time. This is also a very significant group in the Catholic Church in the United States.
Yeah.
And so that's my own faith tradition. And so I wanted to incorporate some of that experience into how I was thinking. And that sense of in-betweenness that people can sometimes feel in this community and in others as well, like in between different identities, in between different worlds, I think has something mystical to it in a way, you know, insofar as it kind of is a mode of ineffability where you can't really say what something is because it's both and, or maybe neither nor. And so God is like that too, I think, to some degree. You know, if we think about God being sort of transcendent and immanent, you know, present and absent, all of these things, I think, relate in interesting ways to that mestizo experience. Mestizo just means mixed.
Yeah.
So that's what we're talking about there.
I like that. And I like that idea about kind of the in-betweenness of the kinds of mystical experiences that mestizo and mestiza mysticism kind of captures. I think that's really important. And there is something that rings true about that, just to the nature of, I'll use another term, spiritual experience. I mean, whether that is sensed to mysticism or not, but, you know, where if you feel you approach the sacred, the divine, if you can approach God in some way, even in modest ways, there is a sense that you kind of dwell between spheres, between the everyday sphere where you live, the quotidian sphere where you live, and some larger space where I think the very nature of spiritual experience is by definition, kind of an in-between kind of state. But of course, that can be both empowering and disempowering if we take that in-betweenness as being a social position of being less than or not as good as.
Well, we're so inclined as human beings, for whatever reason, to sort things into these binary categories.
Yeah.
It's either this or that. And I think God is beyond all of that. God does not work that well in that kind of dichotomous model of reality. And so one of the things I really take from this mestizo mystical tradition is an appreciation for that divine in-betweenness that takes us beyond our kind of binary, simplistic thought forms.
Yeah, great. You know, in the chapter that follows that chapter, you address the residual effects of slavery as they're conjured in womanist and black mysticism. And the term womanist is a coinage, as you point out. I don't think I knew this. I associate womanism with the theologian Dolores Williams.
Yes.
Right? But you point out that is actually the novelist Alice Walker. People know her from the novel The Color Purple and lots of the wonderful things that she wrote, who conjured the term, right, womanism. And you discuss womanism as a mysticism of ordinary life that in quoting you here, emphasizes the grace of divine union, and that finds through that union God's love for a historically abused people. I wonder if you can share an example of how this is so, or what you're doing in that chapter to bring this out.
Yeah, yes. Well, perhaps I can talk about Alice Walker's novel, The Color Purple.
Great.
And her character, Celie, who is the protagonist of the story, and who is a child, a young black girl, who's being abused, not only by kind of the larger racist and sexist society in which she lives, but by her husband and kind of stepfather. And this is really affecting her relationship with God in some interesting ways. And what she eventually discovers is an experience of God's love for her in her embodied self that kind of helps her move past some of that trauma and to claim kind of a sense of herself. And that story is really encapsulating what womanist spirituality and mysticism is about. It's about experiencing the presence of God in your everyday life in such a way that you're empowered to overcome abuse and trauma and injustice, and you know, to find grace and healing and wholeness. So I, you know, people have talked a lot about Alice Walker and Dolores Williams and others, but few have really drawn out the mystical dimensions of their work. And so that's what I was trying to contribute in this chapter.
I love it. You inspire me to go reread Alice Walker's Color Purple. I'm going to do that now again after this conversation, after reading that chapter in your book. And I love the idea, too, about how God empowers people who suffered trauma or abuse or who have been disenfranchised in some way. That rings wholly true to me. And as you point out across the book, mysticism really is, it can be an empowering experience for those who undergo it, whether in exceptionary or just ordinary circumstances. I'm wondering, there's a flip side to that, though, I'm wondering about if you could comment on this. I'm wondering whether in your reading you come across situations when mystical union with God produces these unintended consequences, right? When it takes people who experience it to places they might never have chosen to go, right? Or when it compels them to become people they might not have chosen of themselves to be. And I guess I could phrase my question this way. Are there examples in the mystical record where God not only fulfills us, but also redirects us, or where God communicates something to the effect of, not that, not exactly, instead something more like this other thing? In other words, can God be not only empowering in your experience, but also in some ways give us important pushback and redirection?
I think the answer to that is yes. I'm not sure if this example is what you might be looking for, but Michel de Certeau, who you mentioned earlier, writes a lot about a Jesuit named Jean-Joseph Seurin, who was trying to help this community of nuns who were believed to be possessed by demonic spirits. And people had tried a lot of different methods, but what he tries to do is to basically offer himself as a kind of vessel for this, which is not, I don't think, the original plan. And he ends up undergoing a period of extreme spiritual torment and psychological distress, but that God eventually still draws him out of that. And I don't think that's like, was he empowered or not through that process? And in some ways he was completely debilitated and incapacitated by it. But it was still, I think, a very Christ-like practice for him, you know, to sort of give himself for the sake of another. And so there's that kind of paradox in the Christian tradition that, well, when we say power, we always mean something a little strange by it. We mean a kind of power and vulnerability, a kind of power that's expressed through relationship with others and through love and solidarity, even if that comes at a price for oneself. And
that's so great. Those who save their lives will lose them. Those who lose their lives will find them.
Precisely.
Yeah, that's great. I love that, Andrew. What in this book, I hope people will look for this when it comes out next year. It's such a fantastically insightful and intelligent and spiritually sensitive book. What in it, if anything, surprised you as you worked on it? Were you surprised by things that you saw that you might not have anticipated when you began kind of conceiving of the project or breaking down its chapters and outline?
I suppose one thing I was surprised by was just how frequently the notion of union with God was coming up in these wildly diverse sources, you know, and maybe it's an effect of sort of having that on my brain and then looking for it and then kind of, you know, finding what I'm looking for. But I mean, it really is there. I have the textual evidence to show where it comes up. And it's what that suggests to me is just that this is, at the very least, an idea that we're not done with as a human race. You know, there's been a lot of talk about like, oh, we're becoming an increasingly secular world, disenchanted, you know, all of those sorts of narratives. And I'm just not convinced that that's the full story, at the very least. I think that we're not done with a sense of God's mysterious presence in our lives. And even people who seem to be secular authors still sometimes are very fascinated by this kind of pursuit of divine intimacy. So that to me was the big surprise.
It is a surprise, although it totally rings true, you know, that that God's enduring allure, even for people who write about secular things or who consider themselves fully secular people, is still very much a thing in our modern world, our postmodern, post-postmodern world.
Right, wherever we are now.
Exactly right. Good question where we are right now, actually. Maybe I can conclude our conversation this way, and it touches on where we began. So in your book, Thinking Prayer, that book begins with this sentence: "This is not only a work of scholarship about prayer, nor is it only a prayer articulated through scholarship. It is both at the same time." I guess I'm wondering, what's different about your prayers now, nearly a decade later?
Yeah, that's a great question. If anything, I think my prayer life has become a bit more quiet and less vocal. And I don't fully know how to explain that, but I find myself, you know, stopping and kind of sitting in the silence, and just trying to kind of behold the world in which we live and God's activity in it, and which I think is a bit more of a mystical style of prayer, you might say, but I'm almost hesitant to kind of say that because I don't know, I don't know that I can claim again the kind of heights of mystical experience there, but that's been a shift, and I think I'm just trying at this point in my spiritual life to kind of take things in and to try to really be aware of what God is doing in our world, and it can be a kind of difficult question that I want to sit with. So it still is a sort of thinking prayer. I'm still trying to figure stuff out, I think, in the midst of my spiritual life. But it's a type of thinking that I think is becoming less discursive and more just sort of attentive.
That's a beautiful note on which to conclude. That really is lovely. And thank you, Andrew, very much. And thank you for your just terrific work and for your friendship. It's really a privilege for me to know you and talk to you. So thank you so much.
The honor is all mine. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Sophia Snyder and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips and Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.